There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks, as always, for tuning in as we have a little conversation about some classic cardboard. And we've got a classic set to discuss in this edition as we are looking at a set that is not only designed well, not only loaded with stars, but it was a tipping point set for a trend in the hobby that is still a very big trend these days. And also, it was a tipping point for a stretch of some very brilliant, beautiful sets for several years. In fact, you could argue even for more than a decade. We're talking about 83 Tops, and the tipping point, the accelerator, if you will, the catalytic converter moment in the hobby that was driven by 83 Tops, the rookie card. Yes, the fanaticism for rookie cards really started in 1983. And I do want to give some credit to the other sets that were produced in 1983, because both Fleer and Donruss also played a key part in the creation of the craze for rookies. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I wanted to focus on Tops because as much as I enjoy the 83 Fleer set, it's a really nice set, and the 83 Donruss set was a huge step forward for Donruss compared to their first two issues, 83 Tops is, in my opinion, the best of the three. And also, I just happen to have two cello packs of 83 Tops just sitting in my closet. So it's a lot easier to pontificate about said set when you actually have the materials to do so. So we're going to focus on 83 Tops. Of those three sets, collectors to this day still focus on the 83 Tops set, but as I'll discuss a little later, the Fleer and Donruss sets are certainly nothing to sneeze at. And for 83 Tops, not only was it a tipping point in the craze for rookies, it was the start of a very long stretch of great sets that Tops put out. Now, some were better than others. You could say that 87 was the best of the bunch over the next, say, 10 years. You could argue 91 Tops was up there, or 93 Tops, which we just did a show on. And you could put up a good fight that, all right, maybe 86 wasn't quite as good as the rest, or like I used to think, 88 wasn't very strong. I've come around on that over the last few years. But yeah, I think you have to agree that at least for the next 10, maybe even up to 12 years, some of the best sets, non-vintage category for Tops, came out from 1983 on. So into, you know, 93, 94, I would say up until about there. And then they certainly hit a dry spot several years later. But it was a beginning of a very long stretch, a nice little bounce back from some very generic sets that were released over the previous 4 or 5 years. And again, being that catalytic converter, being that tipping point, that flashpoint of the rookie card going from just kind of a piece of the hobby to becoming a driving force and a reason why a lot of people got into the hobby or even stayed into the hobby. And then there's the downside, of course, it ratcheted up the position of the hobby into a business. Because as we all know, there's a lot of money to be made in rookie cards. So we're going to talk a little bit about the 83 Top set, some of the things that I discovered in the two packs that I opened up, why I'm actually glad that one of the packs I opened had a little bit of damage to it. I know it sounds kind of strange when you open up that 37-year-old pack of cards and you go, oh, thank heavens there's a dinged corner on 20 of the 28 cards. If you didn't watch the video break, you can go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1983 Top Cello Break, and you'll see why, but we'll get into it in just a little bit. And as 83 Tops was a tipping point in the hobby, I think we're living in one right now. I hope your quarantine life is continuing to be successful. I hope that you have not been directly affected health-wise from the coronavirus. I hope that close friends and family members have not been affected. As states and municipalities slowly start rolling out the, you know, reopening campaign, I personally hope that you go out there and do so cautiously. Wear your mask, wash your hands, and also continue to practice social distancing, because until there is a cure, until there's a vaccine, until there is a consistent treatment for this terrible disease, we all have to do our part to try to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And you've seen the polls, you've seen most people, what, like 80% of Americans, maybe even more, are actually in favor of continuing some of the guidelines that are going on now. A lot of that is, you know, just driven from fear. But a lot of it, too, is driven by science and facts. The coronavirus, if you've read stories about people who have suffered from it or who have died from it, it is not a pretty way to go. And a lot of people are taking account of that, and they realize that this kind of new normal, I hate using that phrase, because the new normal will change again within the next few years as this plays out. But the current new normal is something that people are adjusting to. And while some people still don't like it for obvious reasons, some people have also found a new routine out of this. So continue to be smart, be safe, and get the advice from professionals, experts in the medical field, in the science field as well. Don't put your faith in too many people who are up for re-election or trying to justify opening the bar or the buffet counter a little earlier than they should. So just keep that in mind as we go forward. And as we go forward, we will continue to entertain you. So whether you're locked in your house for the next few weeks, or if you are venturing out, you're poking your head out like the groundhog does, make sure that you bring Wax Ecstatic along with you. Our next show is scheduled for Friday, May the 22nd. And I believe, you know, we're talking so much about rookies in 1983. Our next show, we're going to venture back to the early 1990s and focus on the brand that really took the whole rookie thing to a whole new level. And Bowman certainly did that in the early 1990s, and they have done that ever since. That is still their hallmark. Of course, Bowman, part of the Topps company, have been since the mid-1950s. But after the Bowman brand was reintroduced in 1989, collectors not exactly thrilled by the set, even though I think it's a little better than most people say. The biggest knock on it, of course, was the size of the cards. In the throwback homage to 53 Bowman, the problem was is that since 1957, baseball cards were not as big as 53 Bowman's. Nobody really liked getting bigger boxes or different sized sheets to showcase those cards. And when you had Upper Deck coming out in the same year, people didn't really like Bowman when you compared it to the flash and dash of Upper Deck. But the people at Bowman / Topps figured out, starting in 1991, they took care of a lot of the design flaws that were with Bowman. The 91 set's actually very nice. And by 1992, it had a premium glossy look. And by that time as well, they figured out, we're going to specialize in rookies and prospects, and never mind players who might be making their debut this year, but some players who may be a few years from making their debut. So some incredible cards from the early 1990s, including Manny Ramirez rookie cards, Mariano Rivera rookie cards, you name it. If there was a big stud prospect and you had his 91 or 92 or 93 Bowman card, Chipper Jones is another one, you could find some value in that. So we will open up a pack of each 91, 92, and 93 Bowman and reminisce about those days. Some other upcoming shows, we'll be doing a look back, and not necessarily in this order, this is just me talking off the top of my head. We'll be taking a look back at some oddball sets, as we've had a few suggestions from here and there from our listeners on sets that we should cover, including the swell sets of the late 1980s, also the Topps big sets, and the Sporting News baseball great sets. So we will combine all of those into one show in the near future. Again, just kind of looking at some of these off the main street brands or subsets that were released around that same time. And we'll also make another trip back to the mid-1990s, 94 Topps. I've got a few packs from them. And as I mentioned in a previous show, 94 Topps is an interesting set for me because that was the last year that I bought baseball cards, really any new sports cards for a long time. And I still, all these years later, 26 years later, I still have a little bit of a tough emotional pull against anything after 94 Topps. I only bought a couple of packs back then, didn't really care for them, just kind of put them away in a box. And it'll be an interesting reopening, if you will, of the 94 product because I kind of shunned it back then and kind of tuned out sports cards for many years afterwards. So that's what we can look forward to. Also, as always, if I find something interesting on eBay or if things are relaxed enough to where a local card store is open or if a card show can be held somewhere, I doubt it can anytime soon. But, you know, if I do find something outside of those couple of topics I brought up, we will certainly insert those shows as well. And I always appreciate your comments, suggestions, feedback via our Twitter handle at Wax and Gum Stains. Always take show suggestions and ideas there. Can't promise always that we're going to get to them. Sometimes I look at an idea and I go, oh, that's a great idea. And I kind of forget about it. It's nothing personal. It's just, you know, sometimes I just get caught up with something else. But there are several things that, you know, we are working on, and I certainly appreciate your feedback. And we got plenty of feedback at the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed recently, as a lot of people were tagging me in a conversation from a couple weeks ago about the suddenly explosive 1970 season for Bert Campaneras. He hit more home runs. He had a career best in home runs, even though Campy was certainly not known as a power hitter. The Oakland Coliseum was not known as a hitter's ballpark. And there were a lot of other factors. We had a pretty spirited, and I mean that in a good way, but a pretty spirited discussion on why that might be the case and some other one-hit wonders or, you know, one-off great seasons. Brady Anderson, you know, having his 50 home run season, that was brought up in there as well. Although the big difference between Brady Anderson and Bert Campaneras, of course, is that you can't assume that there might have been some kind of steroid issue when it came to Campy, but I digress. Now, outside of that conversation, a few other comments I wanted to pass along to you. First, from Zach Byrne, big fan of the podcast. Thank you so much, Zach, and thank you for your comments as well. He mentioned, in regards to our last show, which was on 93 Topps, loved your deep dive into Dave Fleming and Big Ben. I found a bunch of Dave Fleming rookies the other day. I quit the hobby around the same time Dave peaked, so he was filed as a future star. Isn't that funny when you finally open up the old collection and you look at what was prized or what you thought would be a big hit and it was a miss? Or maybe the other way around, you're opening up that box of commons and then you realize, oops, yeah, this one should probably be in a top loader. That happened to me when I got back into the hobby around 2005, 2006, you know, I bought up a lot of product, and the star cards, the, you know, presumed big name prospects, I put in plastic binders. And I remember, I want to say maybe a couple years ago, I think, one of those rainy day activities, I decided to organize my collection. And for the first time in a long time, I decided to organize the binders. I always seem to go to the boxes, probably because when it comes to needing to organize my collection, it's because I've opened up several packs or a wax box or whatever, and I've just kind of stacked the cards up somewhere. So, you know, I always seem to be going back into boxes, and I neglect the binders. So this one time I decided to go to the binders, and I went to the binder that had some of those cards from 05, 06, 07, around there. And I'm looking at some of these cards, and Boy, I was pulling out some misses, that's for sure. Remember Lasting's Millage? He was supposed to be the next great thing, and then, of course, he kind of fizzled out. And there's plenty of other examples from the early 2000s, some guys that I put a little too much faith into becoming big stars. And took those cards out, put in a few cards that belong there, found a Topps Heritage Madison Bumgarner rookie in pristine condition. I'm like, oops, yeah, that should go in there instead. We'll relegate Lasting's Millage to the generic 2005 to 2009 Topps box that's buried at the bottom of all the other boxes. But it is kind of funny when you go back through your collection and you see who you thought was going to be a big star and wasn't, or who didn't turn out to be a much hyped prospect then, but actually became one. So I'm sure if you go through your cards, you'll find that Madison Bumgarner or the Buster Posey card that you probably should have put in a lockdown case at some point in time, and it was sitting in a box for a while. So again, thanks for the commentary, Zach. Kind thoughts as well. Marcus is a Padres fan living in Texas, and he was commenting on the 93 Topps set and show as well. He says, really enjoyed this episode. 93 Topps was a big set for me, and Archie Cianfrocco is one of my favorite players. That was one of the players that we pulled and discussed at the end of the show. He mentions, I pulled the Fred McGriff black gold as a kid, and it blew my mind. And Marcus included a screenshot of an entire 9-card collection, one of those plastic sheets, of every Archie Cianfrocco 93 Topps card that you could imagine, including the base set, the gold. I've got a mini card here. I've got an autographed card as well, and also a couple of variations of the Topps cards that were put into random packs a few years back, the Rediscover Topps. Remember those? So Topps would, you know, get some of the older cards and stamp them in different colors of foil. And 9 times out of 10, you were dealing with a common card. But if you found one of those commons, it was your favorite player. It was definitely a good find there. So Marcus, thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing all those Archie Cianfrocco cards as well. And I did mention he was a fan favorite in San Diego. Now, Kirby Thomas Jr. Mentioned back on April 29th, he wrote, 1 year ago today, I bought my first baseball cards as an adult. It was a lot of one box of each series of 1992 Stadium Club, brought on by listening to Wax Ecstatic, referred to by Brian Kilby during my brief infatuation with Transformers. And Brian Kilby, of course, a longtime listener as well. And he even added in here as a comment to the original statement from Kirby Thomas. Up until last year, I would buy one pack of Topps Series 1 each year just to look at the new designs. Getting back into baseball cards was meant just to get me back into baseball, which I fell out of with the strike. I wish I'd known just how much that decision would cost me. Yeah, a lot of us who have gotten back into it, even though you can find especially junk wax era cards at discount prices, you're still, especially these days, as you're looking at how much money is coming in, especially if you're dealing with some kind of disruption to your employment, you're going, okay, do I really, really, really need that box of Stadium Club? So you're thinking a little more about it, and then you realize, wow, I've bought a lot of crap at these card shows or card shops. But, you know, at least you're entertained. I always see it as, you know, some people will spend $30 or $40 at a night at the movies. I can spend just as much getting some cards and deriving some enjoyment out of that. And my wife knows I derive some enjoyment out of that too, so she kind of puts up with that. As long as I promise never to have the collection grow to the monstrosity size that it was when we first started dating many moons ago. Now, you bring up a very interesting comment here, Kirby, where you, and by the way, my condolences for getting you back into the hobby via 92 Stadium Club. But I find it very interesting that it was 92 Stadium Club that got you back into collecting. And yes, this podcast was part of it. Yes, your friend Brian was part of it. But I do want to ask a question to our listeners. And I'm actually going to be asking two big questions, a little listener feedback this week. I'll get to the second one when we talk a little bit about 83 Topps and the rookie craze. But what was the set that got you back into collecting? What was it? There had to be one set that made you get pulled right back in. And I'm just curious, because for Kirby, it was a set that was, you know, almost 30 years old. And, you know, a Junk Wax Era set, one that's you can easily attain. And I'm sure a lot of each of those series that probably cost you, what, $30, $35? I mean, couldn't have been that much. And that's if you got it online. If you picked it up at a nearby store, you probably spent, what, $20 on it? So I'm curious about that. I'm trying to remember for me, and I think I may have shared the story before, but 2005 tops. I believe that was the year that they started reinserting some vintage cards. And when I say vintage, I mean just pure 1980s and 90s common cards. But that was enough to hook me, seeing those rack packs hanging at Target and Walmart, and seeing that I could get that 83 Tim Stoddard if I really wanted it. It's in there somewhere. Boy, I had to work for it. That 85 Topps Champ Summers, it's calling my name if I buy this rack pack. So, yeah, we got that to share with you. But I'm curious, if you did get out of the hobby, and many of our listeners did, you got away from it in the 90s when it blew up to be too big. But if you've gotten back into it, whether it's recently or like in my case, 10, 12 or so years ago, what was the set or what was the card that kind of drew you back in? Or maybe it wasn't a particular set of card. Maybe it was a person. Maybe it was your parents. Maybe, you know, your dad died and you're going through his personal belongings and you just find a box full of old cards. Maybe it's a younger brother. You know, who knows what it is. But I'm just curious. I'd find some of those stories to be very interesting. An interesting question from my buddy, Mike McLaughlin, Coach Mike, as I like to call him. He actually sent this to me via text a while back, and I had to do some research on it. But he was asking me, what was Topps' infatuation with the game-winning RBI stat back in the 1980s? And I wrote back to him, I said, you know, I don't know. Let me go look around. Let me see what I can find out about it. Well, the game-winning RBI stat, if you don't know, was a stat that came about in the early 1980s. You could say it was one of the first advanced statistics that was widely used in baseball. Of course, war, all the other stats that started coming out in the 80s and 90s, and that really wasn't broadly accepted until fairly recently, 10 or 15 years ago. But game-winning RBIs was one of the first advanced statistics that came out. And for some reason, Topps loved to publish game-winning RBIs on the back of their cards. And they did this from 1986 through 1989. If you look at the back of player cards, you will see a little stat that's just kind of wedged into the career stats. It says game-winning RBI for the previous season, a game-winning RBI career. And the game-winning RBI is, as it sounds, kind of like a game-winning goal in hockey, all right? So, you know, whoever brings up that score that turns out to be the winning tally, if you will, that is a game-winning RBI there. So there was some thought that there was some value in identifying who had the most game-winning RBI. And on the surface, that sounds kind of neat because you're thinking of, okay, there's clearly a clutch player and whoever has more game-winning RBIs is, you know, the clutch player. And this is somebody you can depend on in a situation to put your team ahead and come through most of the time. The problem was when you kind of step back and, you know, kind of look at the forest from the trees, you realize the game-winning RBI is a very, very subjective stat, because if it's a 2-1 game and the winning run was scored, say, in the eighth inning, well, yeah, the game-winning RBI is kind of a meaningful stat. But if it's a 12-0 game and the game-winning RBI comes from the bases-loaded walk in the first inning by the number 9 hitter, then it kind of loses its pizzazz, doesn't it? And that's the same thing, such as hockey, you know, the game-winning goal. If it's a 2-1 game and that goal is scored in the final minute or two of regulation, or it's an overtime, then yeah, there's some value to it. But if it's a 4-0 win and the first goal is scored 66 seconds into the game, well, so what? I mean, it doesn't really tell the whole story as to what happened. But for whatever reason, Topps was just infatuated with that statistic, even though as time was going on throughout the 1980s, people became less and less crazy about it, to put it nicely. In fact, people were rather opposed to the statistic. Now, I think one reason why is because this was one of the earliest advanced statistics, and people didn't want to have advanced statistics back then. Give me a batting average. Give me an earned run average. Tell me how many base hits, home runs, stolen bases, you name it. And I'm sure there was just some pushback because this was just a different number. This was telling a different story. People weren't all too comfortable with it. But also, going back to my point about how it just didn't really help define a clutch player. And case in point, if you look at the 1988 Topps George Bell All-Star card, this is card number 390, with the All-Star cards in 1988, and Topps did this a lot throughout the 80s, with the All-Star cards, rather than give an All-Star bio or statistics of the player featured on the front, sometimes you just had like a top 10 list of notable statistics on the back. And that's what they did in 88. So if you look at the back of the George Bell All-Star card, his stat is American League leaders in game-winning RBI. So your leader in 1987 for game-winning RBI, think about it. Was it George Bell? Actually, no. So it's kind of odd that that's the stat on his card. Now, he was in the top 10, but he wasn't your leader. Was it Jose Canseco? No, he was actually second place. Was it Wade Boggs? No, he was actually fourth place. What about a hot rookie like Mark McGwire? No, he was tied for fifth. No, the leader in game-winning RBI for the American League in 1987 was Danny Tartable. Now, Danny Tartable, we've talked about him on the show before. He had a notable career, certainly wasn't shabby by any stretch of the imagination. But I would hardly put Danny Tartable in the clutch performer category in the Hall of Fame. Not that there is one, but if you were to create one, you normally don't think of Danny Tartable as the guy. Yet in that statistic, he had a clear advantage over the three-way tie for second place. Tartable had 21 game-winning RBI in 1987. Canseco, Carlton Fisk, and Robin Yount had 17 each. Shortly thereafter, or right behind them in third place, it's a tie between George Bell and Alan Trammell. And then to finish out the rest of the list here, Wade Boggs, Gary Gaetti, Mark McGwire, and Pete O'Brien. So again, even at the bottom of the top 10 list here, when you're looking at Danny Tartable and Pete O'Brien as the bookends, and you see the names that are in the middle here, we're talking Hall of Famers and Robin Yount and Alan Trammell and Wade Boggs and Carlton Fisk, and had they not stuck needles in their asses, Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco as well. So it doesn't really quite tell a good or complete story here. So it just appears, to answer Mike's question, and I again had this discussion with him in some text messages, but I thought I'd actually share it on the show. What I did was I looked at all the Topps cards. I looked at every other card that was completed in that time. So Fleer, Donruss, you had Bowman come along, you had Score come along, and I'm looking in Upper Deck as well. Nobody else had that statistic. So what I think it was Topps feeling like they had an exclusive statistic. They could tell the story a little better than everyone else. And think of the evolution. Think of the evolution of my language here. The evolution of the backs of cards in the 1980s. Fleer started putting pictures of players on the backs of cards starting in 1984. Donruss had a pretty plain card back, but for what little information they put on there, you actually had quite a bit of interesting stuff that they would include. Score, of course, had color photos and incredibly detailed scouting reports on the back. And by 1989, Bowman had the rather unique break down the splits of, you know, how a player performed against other teams in the previous season, and Upper Deck had full color action photos and stats as well. So for Topps, I think what happened was They saw this as some kind of neat little advantage. We've got the inside statistical edge that others didn't. And for a moment, you could say that Topps was putting up a fight, especially with Fleer, because if you remember starting in 1987, Fleer started producing splits as well on the back of their cards. They would have before the All-Star game, after the All-Star game. They would have night games, day games, road games, home games. You had heat maps on some of their cards. So there was a little bit of a battle, but as it turns out, nobody was really clamoring for this information. Nobody cared about the game-winning RBI stat. And again, there was some resistance, I'm sure, from people, traditionalists, who just didn't like advanced stats, like game-winning RBI. Now, the game-winning RBI stat was actually officially dead in the water in 1989. You can still find it on the backs of 89 Topps cards because it's reflecting statistics from 1988. But that is the answer, or the best answer I can come up with to the mystery question, what is it with game-winning RBI stats and Topps baseball cards in the 1980s? And I rather quickly want to give a shout-out to a couple of our listeners, Kurt Humbertson and also John Grachowski, who threw a few kind donations of cards, have helped me just with my own personal collections. John sending a few cards to help me get a little closer to closing off my hand collation of 87, 88, 89, 90, 91 Topps cards. He actually got me the last two cards for 90 Topps. So one of my favorite childhood sets I've been able to put together. Thanks to John getting me those last two cards. So thank you very much. And Kurt was also very helpful in helping me complete the set I had no intention of starting to finish. That would be 93 Stadium Club. I was talking about this on the last show, how, you know, I opened up a box of series one for a show, managed to get no dupes and was able to get the full series. And then series two of 93, I was missing one card. It was the Greg Myers card, and I actually had to pay a few bucks to get a stinking Greg Myers card. But then I recently, again, rainy day activity, decided to open up the Series 3 box that I had. And after I unstuck all the cards because of the UV coating, they were all just jammed together, so they're certainly not gem mint, but I don't care. I was able to get from Kurt the last card, which was Greg Gore. Of all the cards to be missing, Greg Gore, a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers at the time, and also as an added bonus, the Colorado Rockies first card. And that's first, F-I-R-S-T-S, not their first card. But I pulled the Marlins card that was in there, so thanks again to Kurt for sending off the Rockies card as well. And I've got to tell you, it's kind of fun to finish that set because it is a massive set. Was it 750 cards? And I had no intention of doing it. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with it now. It's sitting in a bigger cardboard box. And we'll see. One day they'll open a time capsule and find a 93 Top Stadium Club set. All 750 cards stuck together. And it will be sent off to the Hall of Fame for posterity, or used as firewood, but definitely one of the two. Now, if you would like to make a donation, cardboard or cash, reach out to me. Again, I don't want you just dumping baseball cards on my doorstep, but if you're curious as to some of the sets that personally I'm just trying to complete, you're more than welcome to DM me at Wax and Gum Stains. I can take care of that for you. And also cash donations. As I've said before, I realize the economic situation of the times. So it's a soft sell. If you have a few bucks and you feel like donating it to the program, that's great. You can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And you could send just a few bucks. It helps us keep the program alive and well on our home base at Audio Boom. And it also keeps our archives free for everybody. We're nearing 160 shows, I believe. So all of them can be listened to at any time for free, and we like to keep it that way. I'd rather not charge some extra dollars and cents so that you can listen to a show that we cranked out 3 or 4 years ago. And also, the donations that you send my way will go to the purchase of products. So some of those vintage packs that we open up, those boxes we find, those neat little oddball cards, we do that with your donations. That money does not just go into my bank account. It goes back into the program. And as I like to mention, anytime we have any excess product, maybe we open up a box of cards for a show and we go, I don't want this hanging around, then we make a donation in kind to Commons for Kids. And it's not just the show extras, personal extras as well, as I'm, you know, updating my own sets on the side. And we like to send off a care package to Commons for Kids who collect these cards and donate them to kids who need some help. And not just kids who are in financial distress, but kids who are hospitalized, kids who are dealing with serious illnesses, and they just need something positive in their lives. Well, what's more positive than a handful of free baseball cards? Plus, it helps kids stay connected to the sport, keeps them connected to the hobby. It's not a cheap hobby anymore, as you know. So anytime you can make a donation to a group like Commons for Kids, and there are many other groups, that's the one that I tend to lean on, it's always a good thing. So always know that whatever donations you do make, they do go to a good cause, not just keeping the show alive and well, not just helping us find stuff to talk about, but also passing along a lot of these cards to kids everywhere through Commons for Kids. All right, let's talk about the set that we're focusing on this week. It is the 1983 Top Set, a set that we've talked about a couple times before in the history of the show, but a set that you always come back to because it is, dare I say, the perfect set for Tops. It is one of the best. If you look back at Tops baseball card history, and especially in the 20th century, so let's look at 1951 to 1999. If you had to pick out the top 10 sets of that era of baseball cards from Topps, I'm pretty certain that in top 10 sets, 83 Topps will be one of those sets. And if you had to do top 5, for some people, I think the 83 set would be in the top 5, probably number 5, but you could make an argument why 83 Topps stands out amongst the best of the sets and why it may be better than some other well-regarded sets, including 71 Topps or, say, the 62 Topps set or what have you. But if you may have a favorite from the 50s or the 60s or the 70s, but you could make a good argument why 83 Topps is one of the top 5 sets. You can also make a good argument why 83 Topps is the best set of the 80s. And I know a lot of people will automatically think of 87 Topps, but there are some people that don't like 87 Topps. They think that the wood grain design is a little too clunky, and there's not that many great rookies. I mean, there certainly are some standout rookie cards, such as Canseco and McGuire and Bo Jackson, among others. But when you look at 83 Topps, that's where a lot of the rookies stand out. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But the design of the card, the rookie cards, the star power, the early stars that are in that set really jump out at you for 83 Topps. 792 cards, a very memorable design on the front of the card. In fact, very progressive for Topps in 1983. Take a look back at the 82 set or even the 81 set, where you had very basic designs. Not bad designs. I've always liked the 81 Topps set with a little hat in the corner. And basically, you know, 90% of the card is you know, basically just set to the player, the photograph of the card, rather than, you know, to bells and whistles and graphics and everything. So the 81 Topps was okay. 82 Topps, we like to say, is kind of the hockey stick set. You know, you had the little lines and the swoop down the side. Again, not bad, but kind of, you know, just not very innovative. Well, 83, you had a very clean card that had very little white border, and you also had two pictures on the front of the card. Now, maybe Topps started getting some intel on what the competition was doing. And I said before that FLIR was putting photos on the backs of cards in 1984. I stand corrected. It was actually in 83 when they started. So I'm wondering if Topps had some intel. Hey, FLIR's adding a picture on the back of the card. And the people at Topps said, all right, we'll add a picture on the front of the card. And it'll be a full color photo. And what ends up being produced is a large action photo with a smaller inset photo in a circle, normally of a headshot. And a very simple yet complicated design. I know it sounds a little contradictory there, but with two photos identifying the player's name, identifying the player's position, identifying the player's team, there's a lot going on with the front of 83 Topps, but they made it all work. They made it all fit. It is a perfect jigsaw puzzle. It is a perfect Tetris design, you name it. You know, everything just kind of fits perfectly on the front of these cards. The backs of the cards were also a big step forward, even though they didn't do anything truly progressive in terms of putting pictures on the backs of cards or, you know, advanced statistics. Topps simplified the back. Give me the facts. It was a Joe Friday back on 83 Topps, where you just got statistics, if room allowed for it, maybe a trivial factoid or two about the player, and that was it. You had the gray card stock, you had the light orange background, which was a much needed change from all the green that Topps was pushing out in front of people for much of the previous 15 years. A little bit of a throwback to 78, the orange wasn't quite as dark, but instead of having blue type, they had black. So a very simple but clean, easy to read back as well. So from a design standpoint, 83 Topps is an absolute standout. And as I mentioned before, when you compare it to 82, 81, and you can even go back to 80 and even 79, which were some good but not great sets, 83 Topps was a great set. And it would be the first of several outstanding sets for the next few years. 84 Topps was almost spitting image what 83 Topps did. A lot of the same elements you would see in 84 Topps. 85 Topps, as much as I call it the Cyndi Lauper design, you know, just kind of this goofy MTV pop culture design, still a very popular design all these years later. And then, of course, you've got 86, 87, 88, and as I said before, I think you can go all the way through to 93 at least and say that Topps put together just a good string. Yeah, there were a couple that weren't as good as the others, but a pretty good stretch of 11 seasons of baseball cards, for the most part, pretty decent cards over that time. And it wasn't just Topps that did this. FLIR finally figured it out in 83. They had a very conservative design, and FLIR would have a conservative look for the next several years. But I think FLIR's best days, 83 through 90, they too, like Topps, with the exception of one or two sets, had a pretty good stretch there. Donruss as well, after a very, very clunky start in 81 and 82. The card stock got a little thicker. The photography quality got a little better. The selection of stars and rookies got a little better. So, you know, Donruss was starting to figure it out in 83, and they would have a nice stretch of cards. Even the much maligned 88 Donruss set, which I think it's more beaten up because of the numbers of cards that are still out there. I thought the design overall was good. So even including 88, and I would say, you know, even going through a couple of their goofy sets in the late 80s, through 89, you had a pretty good string of cards from Donruss. That totally went off the rails in 1990, of course. Their 91 set, as I like to call it, the holiday sweater set, or as one of our listeners has called it, the Bill Cosby sweater set. Yeah, it definitely had a 91 feel. So Donruss was kind of trying to find its way back to normalcy in the early 90s. But in 1983, all three manufacturers got it right. It was important for FLIR and Donruss to get it right. It was their third set. They had to improve greatly on their previous two sets. And Topps had to improve as well, because even though the 81 and 82 sets from FLIR and Donruss were not great, they were doing just enough good things to threaten Topps a little bit. And Topps realized they had to up their game to continue leading the pack in all of the baseball card sets that were being produced at that time. Now, while 83 Topps is the focus of the show, something that all three sets got right in 1983 was the inclusion of the three big rookies. Of course, we're talking about Ryan Sandberg. We're talking about Wade Boggs, and we're talking about Tony Gwynn. All three Hall of Famers, and all three with their own Topps cards, or their individual rookie cards, I should say, in all three sets. So these players all standing out, everyone looking for these cards. But also at the time, I always bring up Ron Kittle. Ron Kittle was a big factor in the rookie chase as well. And we'll get into the rookie cards in just a little bit. But one reason why the 83 sets stand out amongst some of the other 80s sets, and this is across the board, not just Topps, but Fleer and Donruss as well, is those three rookies. And then on top of that, because this happened a few years before the junk wax era officially got going, those three sets are not as mass produced as, say, an 89 set. So it's certainly not scarce. You can find 83 Topps. You don't have to look too hard. It doesn't cost you an arm and a leg. It's still, even though it's not as mass produced, and there's value and there's some great rookies, it's not yet old enough to be kind of in that vintage era. A lot of people consider pre-1981 to be vintage, you know, before Fleer and Donruss came around. So there is a premium on 1980 and earlier cards, especially unopened packs and boxes. So 83 Topps seems to fit in this nice, neat little niche where there's great rookies, there's great young stars, including Cal Ripken Jr. and Ricky Henderson, and some of the stars who started their career in the mid to late 70s. So there's a great selection of rookies, a great selection of all-stars and Hall of Famers, or future Hall of Famers, I should say. And even though it's 37 years old, it's not old enough to be kind of totally in that vintage category. It wasn't mass-produced enough, as sets would be 3-4 years later. So you've got a great assortment of cards, you've got a great design, and it won't hurt you financially if you try to put this set together or you're trying to track down certain cards. So it's not as tough of a set, say, like 75 Topps to put together, and it's not a set that is easy to put together but only has one or two valuable cards, like I said, like an 89 Topps set or something like that. So it's in a nice, neat little area there, and you could say the same for like 84 and 85 sets, but 83 is, everything just went well for all the card manufacturers in 1983, and that was great for the hobby as well. And when you look back at the cards from 1983, you not only see the design stand out and the star power as well, but you see that beginning of the rookie card craze. And it's a trend that continues all these years later, and as far as I'm concerned, will always be there. Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, it was a turning point. So much like the coronavirus is going to be a turning point of some sorts for society in general, for the nation in general, for the world in general. When you boil it down to a much more granular look at baseball cards, you could see that 1983 was the turning point for all three major sets, because again, all three had a nice little run of great sets over the next several years. But one thing that drove a lot of those sets over the years was the rookie card. And I think a big factor in that is all because of a mistake Topps made in 1982. Now, rookie cards have been around since the dawn of baseball cards. You can go back to the late 19th century. Basically, any player's first card is his rookie card. And, of course, there's been a lot of debate since then. You know, if a player's card came 3 or 4 years after they made their debut, is it truly a rookie card, or is it just a first Topps card, for example? Or if a player's rookie card came in a traded set or an update set, sometimes it's been delegated XRC, so kind of extra rookie card. It's not part of a base set, it's part of the subset, so does it really count? You can get into the minutiae of that all you want. But the fact is, rookie cards have been around forever. But what changed it to where all of a sudden there was this incredible premium for new rookie cards? And it starts with the old rookie cards. remember that baseball cards and sports cards in general were not really treated as valuable collectibles until the early 1970s, when collectors started pulling together these old collections from people and they started giving them the, you know, coin grading and the stamp collection grading of mint and near mint and excellent and very good. So there was never really a dollar value that you could officially consistently place on a baseball card until the early to mid 1970s. Well, by then, all of the really valuable rookie cards, 52 Mickey Mantle, 54 Hank Aaron, you name it, a Willie Mays rookie here, a Carl Yastrzemski rookie there, a Nolan Ryan rookie there. You know, you couldn't really put a dollar sign on it until the early to mid 70s. Well, the dollar signs for those rookie cards were very high, because if you had that Carl Yastrzemski rookie, you probably didn't take good care of it when you were 8 years old and you're getting it out of a penny pack. Now, maybe you weren't a Red Sox fan or a Yastrzemski fan. You may have just stuck it right in the spokes of your bicycle tire and made a clicky-clack sound, and you completely ruined a card that would be worth thousands of dollars many years down the road. So there's that possibility. But for the most part, a lot of these cards were just mishandled because they were just collectibles for kids. And of course, you've got the stories about moms throwing out baseball card collections. And just like everybody else, every other red-blooded male, you know, you get to 16, 17, 18 years old, you're not collecting baseball cards. You're trying to get the hot girl to go out on a date with you. So maybe even collectors, when they were kids in the 50s and 60s, just kind of tossed those cards aside or gave them to their kid brother or what have you. And that, of course, drove up the value because the shortage of these cards was in greater demand throughout the 1970s and into the 1980s. Then you have that new crop of young stars. So you've got George Brett, you've got Robin Yount, you've got, you know, even from the late 60s, guys like Steve Carlton and Nolan Ryan coming around. And then you've got Paul Molitor, and you've got, you know, some of the other players from that time, you know, Dale Murphy, Ricky Henderson in 1980. So you've got this whole slew of outstanding young talent coming out in the mid to late 70s. And people are thinking back to the dollar value that was assigned to cards that were created in the 50s and 60s, the superstars, the guys that were now getting into the Hall of Fame. And they automatically started trying to link up the top prospect to a card that was really going to be worth something, tens of thousands of dollars if you were lucky, in many, many years. So you had, like I said, Henderson in 1980. You had guys like Kirk Gibson and Harold Baines in 1981. But then the guy that kind of screwed it up for Topps, but also set things straight for the hobby moving forward. And we've talked about this before. We actually talked about 82 Topps not that long ago. It was the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. Back then in 1982, Ripken's rookie in Topps, Ripken was one of three players featured on one of those multiplayer rookie cards, something that Topps had been doing since the early 1960s. Well, the competition one-upped Topps, as Donruss and Fleer had their own rookie cards for Ripken, but they were solo cards. So Topps kind of had to sheepishly make its own rookie card in the traded set in 1982. Now, we'll talk a little bit about traded sets in a little bit, because even that has changed with the rookie frenzy. But that, to me, was kind of the moment where, because Topps didn't have their own individual Ripken card, and you had to put it in the less popular, lesser-known traded set, that Topps kind of went out of their way and said, okay, the next time we've got a big rookie player, he's got to have his own card. And that would be the end of the multiplayer rookie cards until 1992. So trying to move on from the Ripken mistake in 1982, Topps went out of their way to create those individual rookie cards for, in particular, Sandberg and Boggs and Gwynn, but also for some other notable players at the time, such as Willie McGee and also, as I mentioned, Ron Kittle. So in terms of price guides, those two are going to pale in comparison to the other three, but you get the point, where if there was anybody with a scant chance at becoming a major player, and everybody knew that Ripken was going to be a good player. Now, I don't think anybody knew that he was going to be the player, the Cal Ripken that he turned into. Nobody imagined in 1982 that he'd be breaking Lou Gehrig's consecutive game streak and would keep going for a few years afterwards. So, you know, nobody quite knew to the extent that Ripken would be a star player. But it was common sense that he had a really good chance, unless he suffered some catastrophic injury or just totally fell on his face, that he was going to have a long and productive career. So Ripken was kind of that moment for Topps where they just kind of scrapped what they'd been doing for many years, the multiplayer cards. And even though many multiplayer cards featured other players, the Andrew Ridgelys, as we like to call them, for Topps, that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Because as there's more thirsting for rookie cards, the decision was made, because Fleer and Donruss were already doing it, all right, scrap that. Rookie cards get their own rookies get their own cards. Rookie players get their own cards. So you have this abundance of just incredible talent in 1983. And while Topps got it right with those three players, and again, to a certain extent, Ron Kittle, there was a big chase for Kittle cards back then, and Willie McGee. At the same time, Topps fell short of the rookie craze once again. But the good fortune for Topps was they weren't the only one, as both Donruss and Fleer also missed out on one surefire rookie who had a cup of coffee in 1982 and was likely going to be an anchor for his team at his position for many years. Of course, I'm talking about Donnie Baseball, Don Mattingly. So even though all three sets totally screwed up on getting Don Mattingly into the base sets in 1983, it actually turned out to be good fortune for them by accident that they left him to the 1984 sets, all three sets having a Don Mattingly rookie. And that was rather fortuitous for them because that was a selling point for the base sets, because the 84 sets outside of Mattingly, you didn't have as big of a rookie class as you did in 83. Now, something else happens during this time as the rookie craze is heating up, thanks in part to the 1983 sets. Now, all of a sudden, there was a desire to have separate sets starring the rookies. And of course, I'm talking about the traded set, the update set, and the aptly named rookies set. And those are respectively from Topps and Fleer and Donruss. Now, the Topps traded set started as a true traded set. It was kind of a little mini subset in the 1972 set, where Topps in one of the later series wanted to get fans up to speed on some of the big name players who were traded, and Steve Carlton is actually one of them. So there is a Steve Carlton traded card. You can get Steve Carlton in his Cardinals uniform, and then in the later series in the 72 set, you've got Steve Carlton wearing a Phillies uniform because he was traded during the offseason. Topps would come back with several traded cards also in 1974. Of course, 74, they had one series of cards. So a lot of those traded cards were at the end of the set, and it involved players who were just traded during the early winter months of the 73-74 winter trade season, if you will. And you would see traded cards come back in 1976. Again, just kind of little inserts into the factory set. But in 1981, the traded set became an extension of the base set. Starting with card number 793, you had a 132 card set that was basically stapled onto the main set, the base set of 81 Topps. Now, starting in 1982, the Topps traded set would be numbered differently. It would be T1 through 132. Of course, the T standing for traded. And while the traded set started, as the name implies, highlighting players who were traded from a previous team, it also turned into kind of a de facto rookie set. That is where you got the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. That is where in later years you could get a Greg Maddux rookie card in 1987, Jose Canseco in 1986. You get the point here. The traded set slowly got taken over by rookie fanatics. Even though maybe 120 cards in the traded set were featuring players who were actually traded from one team to another, you were always on the lookout for those 8 or 10 rookie cards and trying to guess who would become a big star in future years. Fleer got in on the craze with the update set in 1984. They were able to scoop Topps with the Roger Clemens rookie card. And you also had Kirby Puckett as well in the 84 Fleer update set. Donruss lagging behind a little bit. They didn't create the rookies set until 1986, but they did the exact same thing. It was a smaller set. I want to say it was 56 cards. I might be off a few cards there. But it was a separate set that you could buy featuring just rookie players. So while Topps and the traded set was named after players who were traded, but featured a lot of good rookies, the update set for Fleer also featured a nice little mix of traded players and rookie cards. Donruss just went, okay, we're just going to go for rookies here. And they went straight for the rookie class. Donruss was also first to introduce the rated rookie brand that came around in 1984. And while there were often more misses than hits, it was a very popular subset of the base set. Topps would bring back the rookie trophy, if you will, the all-rookie team cards in the late 1980s. They would also feature future star branded cards as well. And then you have Fleer also featuring future superstars, as they would combine a couple of rookies and add them to the end of the base set. So you could find some interesting rookie duos, say in 1986 and 1987, and all throughout the late 1980s, and in fact into the early 1990s. So what starts with kind of a goof up in 1982 gets turned completely around in 1983 and becomes a mainstay of the hobby for many, many years. Now, as the hobby changes throughout the late 1980s into the early 1990s, and rookie cards become more of a key piece of base sets, and especially inserts of rookie cards in base sets, the importance of traded sets starts wasting away. In fact, Fleer was one of the first sets to slowly just let the update set die in the mid-1990s. Same thing with Donruss. Even though Donruss had some updated sets throughout the 1990s, they kind of died in the mid-90s as well. In fact, Fleer rebranded their update set. Of course, they rebranded the whole company. It was Fleer Tradition, where starting in the late 90s, they basically created sets based on designs from earlier years. And they would release some update sets, but in many ways, the update sets were just a second series of the base set. It wasn't an individual set you had to purchase or individual packs that were clearly marked update or traded, as was the case. Topps traded also waning in the late 1990s, made a comeback several years ago, and Topps is focusing mostly on the traded set, less with players that are traded and more with rookies. And of course, part of the reason why there was this change in the desire to have rookies in the base set, as opposed to kind of being off on the side in these little additional subsets, was the thirst for rookie cards. Everyone was going out on a limb on assuming who would be a big name rookie. And when you had Upper Deck come around, with Upper Deck basically, contributing, 26 cards in the low number series to players, top prospects, players that they thought were going to be big, and Upper Deck was a little ahead of the curve as they were trying to forecast guys who would become big stars 2-3 years down the line. Well, that changed the game again for everybody. As I mentioned, Bowman taking that torch and trying to take on Upper Deck head-to-head in that particular category. And then you also had the other sets, again, kind of shying away from those extra sets, the updates and the rookie sets, trying to place extra emphasis on a rookie class, even if the player didn't really have much of a chance. Basically, anybody who was in AAA and maybe had a cup of coffee in Major League Baseball was deemed a prospect, a hot prospect, a young star, and fans were supposed to buy into that. So it's interesting to see the evolution of the rookie craze. Again, rookie cards have been around forever, ever since the first baseball cards were printed. But thanks to the lack of supply of good quality or good condition, I should say, rookie cards from sets in the 1950s and 60s when they started getting values assigned to them in the 1970s. And a great young class of players in the mid to late 70s, the desire to collect rookies was just really boiling up in the early 80s. And with Fleer and Donruss outdoing Topps in the Ripken sweepstakes in 1982, bygone were the multiplayer cards. Every rookie had his own card in 1983. And if somehow a player throughout the 80s and into the early 90s didn't have his own rookie card in a base set, you could be sure it would show up in that traded set, the update set, the rookie set, or in the case of Upper Deck, having the high series set that was released a little later on in the season. So a quick flashback on 83 Topps. It's a fun set to collect. You can actually get even some of those star rookie cards for pretty cheap if they are ungraded, if they are not going through the PSA process, all right? You can find some of those ungraded Sandberg and Boggs cards. I know I have. Found them for $3 or $4 just in the discount box at card shows. So you can find some. You may be lucky and you have a collector who's got 20 of them, and he just wants to get rid of a few of them, so he'll just mark them down just to get them out. So even the loftier cards in the set are relatively easy to get. And then the young stars, those guys that started their career in the late 70s and early 80s, you can get those cards for a dollar or less in many cases, and that still leaves roughly 720, if you will, or 730, whatever the exact count is, quote unquote, common cards that you can find for just pennies a piece. So 83 Topps is a great design. It's a tipping point in the hobby. It's a tipping point in the rookie card craze. Great rookies, great young stars, great Hall of Famers, great look to it, great feel to it, and you can still get them relatively easy. You will pay more for 83 Topps than, say, 88 Topps, but it is worth the chase, and at 792 cards, not all that difficult to put together, especially compared to some of the sets, the monstrosities that got into the 800 and 900 card range several years later during the junk wax era. Oh, I almost forgot one of the neat things too about 83 Topps, the insert game cards. They did a lot of scratch-off game cards in the early 80s, and I focused on this a little bit in the video break. The 83 game, where you scratched off the different positions and tried to make matches, you could win a trip to the 84 World Series, which of course would be a hell of a World Series between Detroit and San Diego. But some of the secondary prizes are just as interesting as well. If you got three home runs, then you got the trip to the World Series, games 1 and 2 or 3 and 4 of the 84 World Series. If you got three triples, you got a ColecoVision video game system. I mean, we're talking state of the art in 1983, and Donkey Kong. I mean, does it get any better than that? Donkey Kong, for crying out loud. If you got two or three doubles, you got a baseball batting glove, probably Topps branded. And if you got three singles, you were able to get a Topps mini baseball card sheet featuring 1982 leaders. So I thought that was kind of a neat little throw in there. Now, while I was opening these packs, I said before, I was actually kind of glad that I didn't have a perfect second pack. The second pack, roughly 20 of the cards, had the upper left-hand corner dinged. And normally you're not appreciative of that, but because I did not land a Boggs or a Gwynn or a Sandberg fresh out of the pack, I was okay with that. So it's kind of weird when you see the damaged cards when you first unwrap it and you go, oh, I hope I didn't get a good one. And it turned out that way. You're actually kind of happy. So even though we didn't get the big stud rookie cards, we did get Carl Yastrzemski, which is a nice little send-off in a great Hall of Fame career. But we did get some cards with some interesting players and interesting names and interesting hairdos and interesting stories. Now, one of the cards I thought was very interesting was simply because of the jersey, and that was Dan Norman, who was featured in a Montreal Expos jersey wearing Hank Aaron's number 44. Dan Norman was not known for being a home run hitter, as it would turn out. But I remember looking through this pack and just marveling at this Expos batting practice jersey. It's the red jersey you've got the sleeve numbers on, or you've got the uniform number on the sleeve, I should say, and then kind of tucked under his arm, because he's in a batting position, kind of tucked under his arm is the Expos logo. And I've seen a lot of love for the Braves red batting practice jerseys from the late 70s. And why not? It's a very unique look and doesn't quite get the love it deserves. I think a lot of people didn't like the Braves uniforms from the late 70s. The red pinstripes looked kind of tacky, and they were still wearing the blue Indian feather road jerseys that they were wearing earlier in the decade. But the Braves red batting practice jerseys from the late 70s are really starting to stand out and gain some popularity all these years later. I'm wondering why the Expos batting practice jersey from the early 80s hasn't stood out. Or hasn't caught as much attention. I know people love powder blue, but if you look at this Dan Norman card and just look at this red Expos jersey, it's a killer. I love it. So I decided to pull the Dan Norman card because I figured it had to have an interesting story. And what do you know? Dan Norman does have a very interesting story. He was actually drafted by the Cincinnati Reds out of Barstow College, and he was a 15th round pick in the 1974 draft. And while he worked his way up through the Reds system, he never played a game for the Cincinnati Reds. And what's interesting is, as you look at his career, it mirrored fellow outfielder Steve Henderson, who was also a Reds prospect. Well, that's as far as Dan Norman would get with the Reds. He was just a prospect. But he was also part of one of the most infamous trades in baseball history, a trade that Mets fans absolutely hate. You know which one I'm talking about. June 15th, 1977, the franchise, the Midnight Massacre of Tom Seaver, getting traded to Cincinnati along with Dan Norman, Steve Henderson, Doug Flynn, and Pat Zachary. Now, the Midnight Massacre, the Seaver trade was just part of it. Dave Kingman was also traded that night. But Mets fans would never forgive the organization for the Tom Seaver trade. Many fans still haven't, even though the Mets would actually go on to win a World Series in 1986. Letting Tom Terrific go while he was still a very good pitcher. You know, Seaver still had three or four good seasons left in him. But there was a contract squabble. And, of course, we're talking about 76-77, a very crucial point in the history of baseball and labor negotiations, and especially new contracts and free agency, that Seaver disgustingly had to leave the Mets, and it happened in this trade in June. So because he was a prospect in the Red system, Dan Norman was seen as an up-and-coming prospect for a rebuilding Mets team. Of course, it didn't quite work out that way. He would make his major league debut on September 27th, 1977. He played only seven games in the 77 season, but most of his 78 and 79 seasons were going back and forth between the New York Mets and the Tidewater Mets. In fact, he only played 19 games for the Mets in 78, 44 games for the Mets in 79. 1980, he would play 69 games for the Mets. It was his only complete season in the major leagues, but the 1980 Mets weren't exactly something to write home about. Neither was Norman's season. He batted 185 in that season. And at the start of the 81 season, he started in Tidewater. So while you could look at the accomplishments of Steve Henderson and Doug Flynn and Pat Zachary, who were certainly not great players but had more of a positive impact with the Mets, poor Dan Norman was that prospect who never quite lived up to expectations. And when you're traded for a star player like Tom Seaver, you're never going to live up. Even if you're one of the better players, like I'd say of those four, Steve Henderson was probably the best of the four. Even though Steve Henderson had a pretty decent career, he's not Tom Seaver. And Mets fans will remind you of that. So you have to feel for Dan Norman. Here's a guy who lived his major league dream, but just never lived to the expectations of all the fans, and certainly Mets management, who, you know, wanted to make sure that he was part of that deal. So in 1981, he gets sent to the Montreal Expos. In fact, he's traded along with Jeff Reardon in exchange for outfielder Ellis Valentine, who at that point in time was a veteran. And he starts his 1981 season or finishes up the 81 season, I should say, in AAA with the Denver Bears. And he is splitting the 82 season between Montreal and Wichita. So in 1983, when this card is released, Dan Norman isn't even with the Montreal Expos. In fact, he never plays another major league game. He would continue to bounce around in the minor leagues through 1987, ending his professional career at the age of 32. Now, even though Mets fans were not big fans of Dan Norman, you could sense this underlying feeling of sorrow for him. You know, like, here's a guy who, you know, was just kind of thrown into a deal and never lived up to the expectations, and is also under the shadow of Tom Seaver, a Hall of Famer. But I did find some videos on the iBaseball channel. You could just type in Dan Norman Baseball and find this on Google. But there was an interview with Dan Norman several years ago talking about his early years in baseball and playing in the big leagues as well. So, you know, much like a lot of players that don't quite live up to fan expectations, Dan Norman still made it to the big leagues, and he was still able to play five seasons in between AAA and the major leagues, but he was still able to have that major league career. So even though you may knock him for not quite being the stud that every team thought he would be, he still had more major league experience than you or I and most of our listeners. So you don't want to completely completely dump on him for, you know, not quite living up to the expectations of what fans were looking for. Now let's talk about another Reds prospect who actually did stay with the Cincinnati Reds and who turned out to be a rather consistent piece of their starting rotation for many, many years, although it doesn't quite get the accolades he deserves because the Reds were rebuilding for much of the 80s, talking about Mario Soto. Now, Mario Soto, it's so funny. This one stood out for me because I play a lot of out-of-the-park baseball. I'm sure you've heard of that game. If you haven't, it's gotten some prominence over the last few weeks as major league players are playing in an out-of-the-park baseball tournament right now during the coronavirus pause in the major league baseball season. And it's a fun game. It's a very realistic game. I've spent many, many hours, many, many late nights playing it, kind of reliving historical moments in baseball or creating my own, making bad teams good, and in some cases, good teams bad. But any time that I'm playing a team from, you know, the mid to late 70s to the early 80s, Mario Soto is a very interesting player to draft or trade for, because in the game Out of the Park Baseball, he's only really good for like two or three seasons, and then he just kind of fades away. That's somewhat accurate to his career in baseball. Now, he made his major league career debut with the Cincinnati Reds in 1977. He had a pretty hard fastball, good changeup as well. That was pretty much the arsenal there, but he was pretty effective for a couple of years. His best seasons were 82, 83, and 84. In fact, he was an all-star in all three seasons. Nearly threw a no-hitter against St. Louis in May of 1984. Actually finished second in Cy Young Award voting in the National League in 1983. Did you know John Denny was the winner of the National League Cy Young Award? That's not a name that stands out for a lot of people. So in 1983 and 84, if you combine the two seasons, the combined earned run average for Soto was 2.92, and he had a win-loss record of 35-20. Problem was, the Reds, like I said, were not a very good team. Definitely going through some redevelopment here. This is before the Eric Davis days and the Barry Larkin days. Those were a few years off. But Mario Soto stood out as an anchor in the starting rotation. He also stood out as a bit of a red ass. In fact, he is part of two bench-clearing brawls in the 1984 season, one against the Chicago Cubs in May of 84, another against the Atlanta Braves in June of 84. So he had to deal with some suspensions and some hefty fines. After the 84 season, he had to deal with injuries, and his career slowly went downhill throughout 1985 and 1986. In fact, in 1986, in the game against the Montreal Expos, he became the 11th pitcher in Major League history to surrender four home runs in an inning. Now, his big league career would wrap up in 1988, He is a member of the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, despite having a win-loss record of 100 wins and 92 losses and a 3.47 earned run average. Tip of the cap to the Reds for acknowledging that Soto was pretty much one of the few star players that they had at that time. Now, after his playing days, he was working with the team as a pitching coach, and he is at last check in the Reds front office and a big component to the personal success of pitchers Edinson Volquez and Johnny Cueto, thanks to good changeups, which again, Soto, that was one of his key pitches. Now, another interesting player and an interesting card that we pulled out of one of the packs. And it's interesting, you know, much like Dan Norman, I'm looking at the card and looking at the jersey going, wow, that's a pretty cool jersey. When I look at this Rick Sweet card, I see some incredible hair. And I said in the video, it was like a merm. It actually wasn't a merm. It wasn't like John Henry Johnson merm of early 80s. Now, this is as close to Farrah Fawcett Major's feathering that you could get. That was the big design, the big style back in the late 70s and early 80s for guys too. And Rick Sweet is just rocking the lettuce in this particular picture here, as he was a catcher for the Seattle Mariners in this particular card. So you not only have the Rick Springfield hairdo going on here with Rick Sweet, but also that Sweet, no pun intended, a Mariners jersey, the road jersey from the early 80s that I absolutely love, the trident, the sharp trident with the blue M, and it was the blue and gold road jersey that they wore back in the early 80s. They would change it to a gray jersey, I believe, in 1984, which is unfortunate because the blue one really stands out there. Some great colors and a great logo. But as for Rick Sweet, he also has a very interesting career, as he was originally drafted in the third round of the 1975 secondary draft. He was drafted by the San Diego Padres, would spend six seasons in the Padres organization, including one full season in 1978. He would platoon with veteran catcher Gene Tennis. Wasn't known as a great offensive player, but was certainly able to hold down the fort behind the plate. And in 1979, the Padres bring in another veteran catcher, Bill Fahey, from the Texas Rangers. So it looks like Sweet's time with San Diego is going to be on the outs. Well, fortunately for Sweet, he had to go to AAA, and normally that's not a fortunate thing, but the San Diego Padres AAA club at the time was the Hawaii Islanders in Honolulu. So there's worse places to be when you're a young man in the late 70s than Honolulu, Hawaii. Well, unfortunately for him, the New York Mets would buy his contract, and he would spend a full season in AAA, although with Tidewater, not quite Honolulu. And he would start the 82 season with the Mets, and much like Dan Norman, a rebuilding team here. So he doesn't really have much of a chance to latch on. There's really no desire to keep him there long term. So early in the 1982 season, his contract is bought by the Seattle Mariners, where the Mariners, a young expansion club, also not very good, well, they could find a place for him, and he became their starting catcher in 1982 and 1983. In fact, over that season and three quarters, if you will, he appeared in 181 total games and was an anchor behind the plate for a very, what shall we say, immature Mariners club that had all sorts of issues on and off the field and was seemingly a rudderless ship, if you will. Now, after the 1983 season, the Mariners bring in catcher Bob Kearney from the Oakland Athletics in a trade. So Sweet is released. And rather than try to get back into the majors or bounce around in the minors, he quickly switches to coaching. He was the Mariners' bullpen coach, would later move on to the minor leagues. In fact, his first managerial job was with the Bellingham Mariners in 1987. And what rookie played for the Bellingham Mariners in 1987, along with the rookie manager? Yet you guessed it, Ken Griffey Jr. So there's a pretty unique connection there from a long-forgotten catcher for the Mariners to arguably the best player in franchise history. Now, after his time managing in Bellingham, he would move on to the Houston Astros organization, went back into the Mets organization as a minor league manager. Also, the Expos and the Tigers, he really moved around an awful lot. And he was also most recently the manager of the Colorado Spring Sky Sox, which was the Brewers AAA farm club several years ago. Now, he was actually part of the Brewers organization when their AAA club was in Nashville. So he was able to make the move through the organization from Nashville to Colorado Springs. But I thought, other than just a really cool hairdo and a really cool Mariners jersey, and I've actually seen a picture of him with the Sky Sox. He had a really cool Fu Manchu stash going at the time. I just thought it was neat that Rick Sweet, a guy who, you know, unless you're from Seattle, and he's actually a native of Longview, so, you know, also went to Gonzaga University, so, you know, a big representative of the state of Washington for much of his career. Unless you're from Washington or you're a diehard Mariners fan, you probably don't know him, probably don't appreciate anything he did. But when you think he was the first pro manager for Ken Griffey Jr., that's an extra cool thing that's thrown in there. Last but not least, I don't believe we've ever talked about this particular player, but other than mentioning his name, and he's got one of the greatest names in the history of baseball, but certainly in the 1980s, Fuss. Yes, Johnny Bilton Walkin' Fuss. He played multiple positions, although he's known as a catcher at this particular juncture in his career that lasted from 1974 to 1985. Most of that time with Detroit, in fact, 83 would be his last season with the Tigers. He would finish up his big league career with the Phillies in 84 and 85. Now, he could not only play multiple positions, including catcher, and he had a great arm too, so he was utilized not only at catcher but often in the outfield. But he was a guy who had a very bizarre batting stance as well. So not just a batting stance, but the bizarre name, an ultimate utility player that you can move everywhere. A Walkin' Fuss was very quick to become a bit of a fan favorite. Of course, as the Tigers brought in a youngster named Lance Parrish behind the plate, that's when you saw Walkin' Fuss moved around the field just a little bit. Career 262 batting average, 86 home runs, 310 RBI, and like I said, his defensive prowess stood out a little more than his offensive numbers. Originally a pitcher in high school and drafted by the Washington Senators late in the 1967 draft, he was in the Senators farm system for 5 years, moves with the organization to Texas. The Rangers eventually trade him and Mike Nagy to St. Louis for Jim Bibby, and then later in 1973 traded from St. Louis to Detroit in a deal that you could argue was an absolute steal for the Tigers, as they just had to move minor leaguer Lawrence Elliott to St. Louis. So after the trade, Walkin' Fuss kind of settles in primarily as a catcher, like I said, and ultimately as a backup catcher, but a guy that could be moved around anywhere in the lineup or anywhere on the field. And he also had a very interesting life off the field as well. Now, during a locker room speech by an evangelist, this was in May of 1976, Walkin' Fuss suddenly found Jesus. So here's a guy who had a bad temper, didn't make some wise choices early on in his life. Well, all of a sudden, there's this locker room speech by an evangelist, and all of a sudden, boom, he's born again. He's found God, and he also found his bat. In fact, he had a very good 1977 season. Statistically, part of that was due to that strange batting stance that he had. And Walkin' Fuss became a favorite under Sparky Anderson, mainly because he was a guy that you could maneuver all throughout the field. Now, in spring training of 1984, Walkin' Fuss musing that he would be happy to be traded to Philadelphia, which was close to his home in Wilmington, Delaware. He didn't like how much he was getting paid. He didn't like the playing time he was getting. And he was also putting down some of his teammates publicly. So, of course, not surprisingly, that earned him a one-way ticket out of Detroit, out of an eventual world champion to the defending champions. He was traded along with Glenn Wilson to Philadelphia for two players who would be key cogs of that 84 championship, Willie Hernandez and Dave Bergman. Now, Joaquin Fuss would play two seasons for the Phillies as his career petered out late in the 1980s. He was a bullpen catcher in 1985, and he challenged the Phillies to pay him, play him, or release him. So in August of 1985, the Phillies released him. There was really not much argument there. Now, Joaquin Fuss would try to make a comeback in 1986 with the Detroit Tigers, also the Boston Red Sox. Didn't quite work out that way, so his big league career as a player was done. Now, however, after the 1986 season, the Tigers did bring Joaquin Fuss on board as the manager of their farm team in Lakeland, Florida, the Lakeland Tigers. And he would also be a manager later on in his career in Glens Falls and also in Toledo. He would catch on in the Pittsburgh Pirates organization for several years and decided to leave the organization in 1994, focusing on his own business, which was a baseball and softball academy. Now, he would get back into professional managing in the late 1990s and pretty much called it quits after that. Now, some sad news with Joaquin Fuss, as I was doing a little research on him, he is dealing with dementia right now. That story coming out late last year. So unfortunately, the fan favorite in Detroit, not necessarily the favorite in the locker room, certainly a unique individual on and off the field, John Joaquin Fuss, certainly hope that that battle with dementia is one that he can fight fairly well as time goes on. Well, something that lasted fairly well throughout all the years, 83 tops, a great set to collect, a fun one just to open up packs. Even if you don't land that big rookie card, you can always find some pretty interesting names and stories in the packs. And as you continue your quarantine life, if you can find some 83 tops somewhere, it's definitely worth the money and worth the time to get that and put some back into your collection if you gave many away years ago. Now, don't forget that you can comment on this program or the cards or any of the players we talk about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. If you have a few extra dimes and nickels, you can send them your or our way to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, we always appreciate any donation, be it card or coin. And make sure you join us again in 2 weeks. May 22nd will be our next show, and we will be taking a look back as scheduled right now, as we'll be taking a look back at another phase of the rookie card frenzy when Bowman grabbed the mantle of the rookie card set in the early 1990s. We'll look back at the 91, 92, and 93 sets. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.